The location of the country's latest mass shooting is revealed. Obama meets with America's schizophrenic voices to urge less bloodshed. And desperate Americans everywhere just try to get on board with senseless violence. Buckle your seatbelts, put your computer away, and never watch web videos while driving. This is The Onion Week in Review. As news of the Federal Reserve Chairman nomination process continued to unfold this week, The Onion maintained its continued journalistic integrity by refusing to cover any part of the shameless clickbait involving the nation's banking system. Onion reporters spoke candidly about their decision, saying that readers visiting theonion.com will see no mention of eye-catching names like Janet Yellen or Lawrence Summers and will never be lured into clicking on titillating articles about the history of the Federal Reserve Board. According to a new report released this week by the Department of Transportation, the average American scoots over approximately 10 miles per year on park benches, baseball bleachers, and picnic tables. The study, which also accounted for scooching, sliding over, and moving on down, found that over the course of their lifetimes, most Americans ultimately scoot several times the length of the English Channel, the coastline of Uruguay, or the length of the Tigris River.
Between the various types of communal seating, the typical American scoots nearly 1 mile each month, and if you count instances of scooting over, seeing the other person has already found a place, and then scooting back, many Americans travel much farther by scooting than they do by motor vehicle.
While out for drinks with coworkers this Wednesday, local shipping clerk Russell Chambliss told reporters he was extremely unsure if he was being bullied by his male colleagues or bonding with them. Chambliss said that while he was repeatedly demeaned and physically tormented by his male coworkers throughout the evening, they nonetheless did it in a collegial manner, leaving him ultimately unsure whether to feel insulted or honored.
I'm pretty sure that Bill called me limp dick earlier, and Todd keeps punching me in the shoulder. Pretty hard, too. I told Jeff about this problem that I was having with my girlfriend, and he called me a pussy and then walked away. But then, like 5 minutes later, he came back with a beer that he had bought for me. What does that even mean?
And in local news, a grandmother is shown around the retirement home where she will die. In other news, a 250-pound man is sadly in the best shape of his life. Grand Theft Auto V is a sophisticated gaming experience, according to a man who spent 3 hours running over homeless people with a fire truck, and it's unclear if this is the type of fountain you're allowed to run around in. What you have just witnessed may have shocked, startled, or disturbed you, but The Onion apologizes for nothing. For more fearless coverage, keep checking TheOnion.com.
The Liberty Radio Network presents the latest episode of Mark Stevens' No State Project. Download it, listen to more, and read more from Mark at markstevens.net. That's markstevens.net.
Welcome to the No State Project. I'm your host, Mark Stevens, author of Adventures in Legal Land and the beta released Government Indicted, which we should have the formal release of Government Indicted in just a few weeks, I promise. And you can hear the show here on markstevens.net, also the network, lrn.fm. And you can also check out markstevens.net for the local affiliates that may be carrying the show in your area. We are rebroadcast on Awake Radio with our own Vin James, who does the No State Project UK. From the balmy shores of London, and that'll be on. It starts at noon GMT on Sunday. We are not live today, so do not make any calls or Skype. We are not live. Actually, like I mentioned on the show last week, I have somebody I've been trying to connect with for a long time. I actually had heard of him about a year ago because I was watching a YouTube video of Larkin Rose, who's been on the show before, good friend, who actually should have been at Libertopia, but so we missed him this year. But there was a video about the Trivium, and it was really good. I don't remember where Larkin and my guest were speaking, but it was excellent. It was about critical thought. His name is Jan Irvin. I really and his website is gnosticmedia.com, and I'm really glad to have him on. Welcome to the show, Jan.
Thank you, and you would be talking about Mark Passio's Free Your Mind conference in 2011.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, 2011. Yeah, you and Larkin. Do you know Larkin Rose?
Yeah, well, ironically, he's my girlfriend's second cousin.
Oh, look at that. What a smile. Wow. Very, very cool. Very cool.
They grew up across the street from each other.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah, and I believe Larkin grew up in Pennsylvania.
in Brynathyn.
That's right. Yeah, Larkin's. Larkin is one of the few. I know somebody had made a comment recently about his some of the things that he had written about and his talk at the last Pork Fest about why speak on violence, and this individual was banned or thrown out of the Free State Project, and he had made a claim that Larkin and he were the only ones that talk about using morally justified defensive force against others, whether they're cult government or not. We've been saying on the show, somebody breaks into your house, doesn't matter what kind of uniform they have on, take a headshot. So, but at least here on the No State Project, we're not pacifists. We believe in morally justified defensive force, that if somebody uses aggressive force and violence against you, we have a moral obligation to put that down. And just because they have a badge or some kind of high, mighty, and title or whatnot, does not excuse their thuggery. And unfortunately, I've been catching myself, though, Yana. I did a hearing the other day, and more than once I used the phrase thugs or thieves. So I have to kind of watch myself there. But I really was impressed by the talk that you did. And I had read a lot of stuff about Laurel Canyon, the work that David McGowan has done. And I urge people to go. I don't remember David's... You're going to have to look up David McGowan and...
You just search Dave McGowan, Laurel Canyon, and it pops right up in Google.
Yeah, his website, which, I mean, I thought, I'm not much
local
of a tech
host
guy.
Local host something, I don't know. He's got some crazy name for his website.
But he's got really good stuff, and I know that's something that you have also, and I think you've done a little bit more research into that, but that's not what we're necessarily talking about today. Maybe
sure.
We can get into that.
It's davesweb.cnchost.com.
Okay, that, yeah. we'll get that in the show notes. And it's just a stripped down website, and it's the research that's out there, and you can verify things. You can do your own research, and great stuff. And I got to say, real quick, I didn't want to accept. What I want to talk to you today is about critical thinking and the trivium, because I believe that the reason why the world is in the state that it is, the reason why we still have governments and an involuntary society based on slavery, is because the majority of people do not engage in critical thought. That's
right.
And what I did not want to accept, and the truth is there, is that a lot of the, let's say, the co-creators of NLP, and a lot of people that they were associated with, come out of the UC Santa Cruz, which is, with Gregory Bates. I actually quote Gregory Bates in a number of times in my new book. And when you had laid out the connection with Huxley and Bateson, I was like, oh, really? Really? Oh,
sure. God. Well, Bateson was one of the key guys behind the Josiah Macy Foundation conferences in the 1950s that were key behind the development of the CIA's MK Ultra program. And so we've done a lot to expose that. But apparently, Aldous Huxley, from what we can tell, was the key guy running MK Ultra. And then I just interviewed General Stubblebine on my show last week, and he came out and admitted on my show that, in fact, Huxley was an agent. He refused to give me the position that Huxley was in, but he did to confirm that Huxley was an agent. And he did confirm that, in his opinion, Aldous Huxley did run MK Ultra. Now, and I also exposed last year in my article on Gordon Wasson that he was in charge of MKUltra Subproject 58. And for those who don't know who he was, he discovered, quote unquote, discovered magic mushrooms. And so we know now that he was CIA heading Subproject 58. And so just going on this path, we started investigating all of these people, and I used to be big into Terrence McKenna and all of this kind of stuff. And I inherited a bunch of his archives back in the early 2000s, and then we discover recordings of him admitting that he was a deep background agent and a PR guy for either the FBI or CIA. And we had been following this for more than a year, and all of this stuff starts coming out. But recently, going back to your comment on Dave McGowan, we published an article which people can find on the Gnostic Media website, but it's Manufacturing the Deadhead, and it really you know, shows how all of these ties between Gordon Wass and these bankers and the music industry and the CIA sort of all came together. And, you know, it was all they PR'd all of this stuff. And we've got, you know, a lot of the quotes and things like Gordon Wass. And he was the vice president of propaganda for J.P. Morgan Bank. But he also hung out with Edward Bernays, the father of propaganda, for a decade, you know, and then all of these guys tie in and makes a nice little tidy package. But Dave McGowan's work was key for us to put together a lot of the other pieces. I've tried to get him on my show a number of times, but I don't know. He keeps chickening out. I don't know why.
You know, he's not a full-time guy. You know, from what I've seen, he's just he just doesn't, you know, I know he...
Well, he agreed to come on my show.
Oh.
And then, you know, I called him up to do the interview. No answer. I'm like, okay. Huh. Yeah.
Well, I know there's another show, another internet show that he does on a regular basis, or at least he used to. But, you know, some people, I've always wanted to have Carl Wattner on from voluntarist.com. And, you know, he's had other people, you know, come on instead. He's just not a public type guy. So, you know, if you do a search, McGowan has not done much, you know, too many interviews at all.
Sure. So I mean, why agree to do an interview? And I was, you know, he lives down the 210 for me, the 210 freeway. And, you know, it's like he's maybe 45, 55 minutes from me. And I was saying, hey, you know, why don't we grab the cameras and we'll come down, pick you up. We'll go drive down to Laurel Canyon. We'll film all this stuff. We'll make some documentaries, you know, help you promote your work. And it'll show how it all ties into our work, et cetera. And he seemed like he was down for it and then bailed out.
Wow. I don't know. I would take – there was a number of things I took issue with. But one of the things I thought was a little odd, and I know this is such a minor superficial thing. I didn't, and I want to get into the trivium here in a second. I really didn't accept the characterization of the Doors as being bad musicians. But
well, I mean, I guess, you know, I've seen the rest of the Doors play with Echo and the Bunnymen back in the 90s when they were touring around with Echo, but I wouldn't necessarily go with that they were bad. I mean, like the Byrds, for instance, I interviewed Sue Palakis last week and I still haven't released it yet, but she says, oh yeah, you know, the drummer, you know, and they live next door to Sue and Vito Palakis. The drummer, he never knew how to play before and he just came in one day and he started playing. I'm like, that never seemed odd to you? You know, they're all agents. They're all the sons of intelligence officers. He just shows up one day and suddenly becomes a famous drummer, you know, never drummed before. It's just such a corny storyline. It's, you know, here they are in Laurel Canyon and like all of their neighbors and friends become these massive rock idols like for the next 50 years, right? And I think of all of my friends that have been in bands and stuff. Let's see, I used to know the bass player for Agent Orange, and I used to know the guitarist for Static X. Now, those are the only two musicians out of all of the musicians I've known my whole life that have ever made it. And I just think, wow, so here is this group in Laurel Canyon, and they all make it, you know? What's the chance of that? And she just, you know, I think she was just totally hoodwinked. She doesn't see any problem with the official storyline whatsoever, you know?
Well, there's always going to be doubt, and even though you can make so many connections, you make them, and of course, David McGowan makes an incredible list of connections that you have to at least say, even if it's not concrete, when you look at all those connections, and, you know, like Jim Morrison's father being in the Navy, the Admiral, and being, you know, in, you know,
Gulf one of Tonkin the incident and all
right,
that.
You know, there's something, you at least with all these connections, there's something really odd going on. And we know we don't have the complete picture, but when you have all those connections, there's something really odd going on. But of course, there are still legitimate musicians. I mean, you look at some of these
sure.
anti-establishment type of guys like one of my personal favorites, like Michael Bloomfield of the Electric Flag and the Butterfield Blues Band. This was a guy that was totally against, and the whole idea was to play and not be this. You know, but anyway, we'll get back to that. I've already got
sure.
my notes here, and I want to get back to that. I want to discuss the trivium. And then, and why the critical thought is so important, and so explain that. And then, because one of the questions I want to get into is this something that's deliberately not taught to the masses?
Sure. Well, and on that point, I should say that most people actually approach this subject thinking that they have already have critical thinking, okay? And this was my attitude when I first heard about it as well, because you don't want to think, you know, nobody wants to think that they don't personally have critical thinking. And your listener is going to be sitting there right now getting all defensive. Well, I have critical thinking. But what we need to do is approach every new subject as though we're totally incompetent and we've never heard it before, and then we gather the information and move forward. Now, in ancient times, there's a lot of evidence that, well, there was basically two forms of the trivium, but the trivium in some times and places was used for the free class of people, and then used by the free class of people to keep the slaves as slaves. Now, essentially, what the trivium is the lower part of the seven liberal arts, and the trivium and the quadrivium together make up the true seven liberal arts. Now, if you've never studied the trivium and the quadrivium together, then I promise you, you don't have critical thinking in this sense. Now, a lot of people have some form of it naturally and inherently, so they will have some amount of it. But what happens is when you begin to study the trivium method, it makes it a systematic process based on how the mind naturally works. And then we can always have a way to go back and check things and verify information when new information comes in. Or if somebody brings in new information, we have, you know, we can already go through and say, oh, you know, I've already done all of my grammar on this. I know that that new bit of information is false. And when we think of grammar, think of looking out in the world in front of you or outside your window and you see streets or a wall or a house or telephone poles or whatever, plants, all of these things. These are nouns out there. And so, you know, the nouns, the verbs, the adjectives, et cetera, these are what make up reality around us. And so whenever we're dealing with information, we always have to know, we always have to have knowledge of those nouns and things that we're dealing with. And so that's the first step, you know, essentially. And the nouns are based on who, what, where, and when, essentially, getting that primary basis there in place. And then the next phase of the trivium would be why, and then the last phase is how. And these actually have to go in order. And so, you know, what, anciently speaking, and I mentioned there were two forms of the trivium. There's the classical trivium that was promoted by guys like Marshall McLuhan, that's used by military and intelligence for manipulating and controlling and fooling other people. And it's basically using sophism or using word tricks to fool people. And then there is the trivium method, which is the antithesis of the classical trivium, which essentially reveals how the classical trivium works. Now, for those of you who want more information on this specific subject, I recommend going to, you can find the video on my triviumeducation.com website, which is another website I run. And if you go there, you'll see Richard Grove and Kevin Cole's video, Classical Trivium versus the Trivium Method. And that video is very important for people to understand because, and you do actually need to study both. You can't just say, oh, well, the classical trivium is bad, I'm going to ignore it. No, you actually have to study it, because if you don't understand how the sophism works, it can be used against you. So, you know, basically the trivium is who, what, where, when, why, and how. That simple. And this is stuff that most of us were taught in second, third grade, et cetera. But the first part of that, the who, what, where, and when, that makes up the grammar. And then the why makes up the logic. And then the how makes up the rhetoric. So, you know, as Richard Grove explained it, or he came up with this idea, if you think of it in terms of a computer, the grammar or the who, what, where, and when, that's your input. And then the why, that's your logic or processing in the computer. And then the how would be the output, like what shows up on your printer or your screen or comes out of your speakers, et cetera, on the computer. So now if you just stop for a second and you think, well, what would happen if I took those out of order? What would happen if I put why or logic before input. What would happen if I put processing before input? Well, as the old adage, garbage in, garbage out. So if you don't have processing, or if you don't have input before processing, what are you processing? Well, like all of the New Agers, you channel it from Uranus. And so this is where the information ends up coming from. And then people literally just make it up. They lie through it. They BS their way through it. And so, this is actually key in systems of social and mind control. And what happens is it destroys people's self-esteem, as does the New Age movement and things like quantum physics, which we've revealed on my show is also a total fraud. I've had David Harriman on my show, who's the author of Logical Leap, and he did a 6-hour lecture series called The Philosophic Corruption of Physics, where in which he reveals the quantum physics is essentially a fraud, but it gets people to not trust their own five senses. And when you get that logic is the art of non-contradictory identification, and there are no contradictions in nature, only in the mind of man, like when you look outside out that window again and you look at all of those nouns, they're not, you know, you never see two nouns in contradiction with each other. They're not, you know, you don't see a birdfish or wall tree. I mean, you might see a wall growing, you know, or a tree going over a wall or things like this. But, you know, you don't have, unless that we know we intentionally made them, you know, these nouns stay separated, you know, and this excludes GMO, genetic modified, whatever that, you know, Franken, whatever that they're creating out there. But, you know, so there are no contradictions in nature, only in the mind of man. And when we get this, we can get the trick with quantum physics, which is basically to get people to believe that there is no truth, that you can't trust your own five senses, that there's up to 11 contradictions coexisting simultaneously. So therefore, you can't know anything. It doesn't matter the change you get from your grocer. You know, you can just wishful think it up. If you walk outside and your car is missing, you know, it didn't get stolen or towed away. It, you know, it elevated to the next, you know, dimension or whatever. This is the kind of garbage that they want to sell people. But when we get back to critical thinking and we get back to realizing that quantum physics and all of this stuff, the reason why these physics professors have all been debating over the facts of quantum physics for 90 some odd years and why none of them understand it is because they're debating the contradictions in their own minds. They're not debating the facts of reality. And so they're all befuddled by their own lack of logic and critical thinking, essentially. And so when you get the joke, you know, you can go back through and you can realize, oh, okay, there are no contradictions in nature. I can verify things. I can know truth. I can make good decisions based on the grammar that who, what, where, when out there in reality. And I can know things. So what happens then is it really rebuilds your self-esteem and self-confidence in being able to go out and find information and check it and know that the information that you have found is correct and true. And of course, the quantum physics people want you to think that there is no truth out there. Again, you can't know anything, but you can get out there and check the citations. You can understand that when there is a contradiction, it is an error or a lie. And so when you get a contradiction, when you get A and B or A, B, and C rather than just A or B or C, then you have to look at it. Okay, why do I have these contradictions? And the first thing we do is we remove the logical fallacies. We go back down to the primary evidence and we check it. We figure out which one it is. Okay, this one is based on fallacies and I can't verify it. This one is based on verifiable citations and primary documentation. I did verify it. So we toss out the one and we keep the other with the one that's left is truth or fact. And so this is the simple process that has actually been conditioned out of us through the compulsory education system. So again, it's simply who, what, where, when, why, and how, always in that order. And again, how they control people, the most simple way, and there's other ways too, which we'll get into in a moment, but one of the most simple ways to control people is to get them to put conclusions or why before who, what, where, and when. To get them to, you know, like the old adage, don't confuse me with facts, I've already made up my mind.
Right.
When you get people to put their logic before their input, without input, they can nearly never come to an accurate conclusion. So then they're left to appeal to the person with the false appeal to authority, the ad verecunium fallacy, the judge sitting three steps up on the bench, the doctor in a white coat, the policeman, the politician, etc. So this is all done intentionally. And so people turn and, you know, without having logic first, they're left to appeal to authority.
Well, I quoted Kipling in my first book that I carry six honest men with me. The names are who, what, where, when, why, and how. And I have, if you want to get the deer in a headlight look with a bureaucrat, you just ask them a very simple question, especially if you're in some kind of hearing, like what I did on Monday with the NHES, where you ask them, because you want to understand the process, you want to understand what kind of standards they have, because they're going to claim it's fair. Oh, okay. Well, do you hold an objective standard of proof? And Jan, every time I get the same question back, what the hell do you mean by an objective standard of proof? And I'm, you know, like, well, how can you conduct a fair hearing and determine what's true and what's not if you don't even know what an objective standard of proof is? You know, so just to be short, you know, to kind of sum up a lot of what you've already said is, and I'll ask them, well, let me ask you a question. Do you look at the facts first and then form an opinion, or do you form your opinion that then has to conform to the facts? And then the light bulb usually goes off.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. And I see it all the time, you know, with my research exposing MKUltra and the, you know, Gordon Wasson and Terrence McKenna and all this stuff. You know, aside from the intentional stick with stupid disinfo agents that constantly promote this sort of stuff, you constantly get these spiritually enlightened new age psychedelic heads that come at you name calling all manner of things at you in their spiritual enlightenment because you dared to expose their religious hero. And you know, it's just amazing. It's like, wait, you know, you're supposed to be elevated and evolved to having done these things, and why are you sitting here name calling at me and making up lies about work that you've never read? And you know, 99.9% of the attacks come from people who have never read any of my work, never listened to any of my shows, any of that stuff. Or maybe they've heard one or two, but they don't go, you know, through the evidence. They won't read the citations, you know. And I've had a number of people say, well, your conclusions don't add up. Okay, which ones? Your conclusions.
Which conclusions?
Based on what? Well, yeah. Your conclusions just, well, can you quote them so that we can review them? No, that would take too much time.
I had some lawyer who runs a website, and I don't want to give that out because they don't deserve any extra traffic, but he had disagreed with one of my articles, and I said, what in particular? And he tried to get all fancy with me. I said, well, reductio ad absurdum. Okay. What did you disagree with, though? Well, reductio ad absurdum. Yeah, I get that. He says, Mark, do you know what that even means? Yeah, I do. But what part of the article in particular did you disagree with? I said, I laid it out in seven logical steps, at least what I thought was seven. Which of the seven do you disagree with? And he couldn't give me anything. He says, I think your conclusion is absurd. Yeah, but
what he's saying is that you've reduced everything so far down to the facts that it's absurd. So his argument is essentially it's like a weird version of an appeal to ridicule. Okay. So he's saying, okay, well, you've reduced it all to these facts, and so therefore it's wrong, ha, 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 ha. You know, an appeal to ridicule is when you say that something is wrong because ha, 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 ha.
Right.
That's it. That's your whole argument, right? And so in a way, you know, he obviously didn't provide any argument, but he named some fallacy that he thinks, without dealing with any single points in the work, he just created a fallacy. Oh, well, you broke it down further than I've ever thought about it. So therefore, it's got to be wrong. It's reductio ad absurdum. Well, but
yeah.
he doesn't realize that he has to focus on each individual point, right? And he fails to do so.
Right. And so, you know, and I even tried to get out of him. I said, do you disagree with the conclusion from 6 to 7? And he wouldn't be specific. I said, did I make a leap in logic there? Is there a gap in my evidence from 6 to 7? What happened from 6 to 7 that leads you to believe that 7 is completely wrong? He says, and basically came out because it's ridiculous. Like, it's just because it I can't accept that.
Right. Yeah. It's just that's literally an appeal to ridicule. He's, you know, they're just saying he's attacking you. You're ridiculous. So therefore, it's wrong. And I can't think of a valid conclusion.
Yeah. I thought it was just a very weak type of gaslighting.
Sure.
All right. Whatever.
You
okay.
Know, yeah. Well, you know, most people, you know, like I said earlier, they channel things from Uranus and they, you know, they don't think, they don't base their decisions on facts. And this has actually been conditioned into people. And, you know, this is why the trivium is so important, because when you get that there is an input and then a processing and then an output, I mean, what would your computer do without any input? You know, it's like it has to download something. You have to type something in the keyboard. You have to put a disk in the drive or a jump drive in the USB slot. I mean, something, you have to have something going in there. It doesn't just, you know, automatically do something. And yet people think that their brains work this way. You know, it's just, it's amazing. But when you get that there is a process, general grammar, you know, answering the question of who, what, where, and when of any subject, and then formal logic, answering the why of a subject, and then rhetoric, classical rhetoric, providing the how of a subject. And so when we go through it in this way, we can see, oh, well, I gather the information, the who, what, where, and when, then I process it. I look for any contradictions, because I know that contradictions are errors or lies. And then not only am I going to look for contradictions, I'm going to look for fallacies. And then I'm going to look for two types of fallacies, formal and informal. And then on top of that, I'm going to go through two processes. I'm going to check the fallacies in the information coming in. And one step further, I'm going to check for fallacies in my own thoughts. And then once you've gone through these phases, then you come to, you know, and if you think of general grammar as knowledge, it's knowledge of those things around you. And then logic is understanding, because you've processed all of the contradictions and fallacies out. So now you have a clear picture of it. You understand it. And then rhetoric would be wisdom, because it is systematically usable knowledge and understanding together. Okay. So then, you know, whenever you express information to others, it's the rhetoric aspect. So here's another way to think of it. General grammar, like if you think of take your car and you have all of the parts all over the driveway and you learn all of the names of them and you're laying them all out there, that would be your general grammar. That's all the nouns. And then logic would be, you've taken all of those parts and you've gotten them together and you put the key in and the damn car started. That's logic. All the everything is put together. It makes sense. It's working. All of the contradictions are removed. And then the rhetoric would be your explanation or the manual that you wrote of how to do all of that you gave to others.
Right. And then you lather, rinse, repeat. Because this is not a closed system.
It's not a closed system.
Right.
And that's what people don't get, is that, you know, the fallacies, they'll say, well, then you can't ever come to truth, you know, blah, blah, blah. The fallacies, and understanding that there is something such as the fallacious fallacy also, the fallacies keep you from dismissing information, you know, such as killing the messenger, which most people do. They'll kill the messenger before they ever hear what the message was. Without using poisoning the well fallacies or ad hominem attacks, you're wrong because I can call you a dirty name. Ha ha ha. You get all of those things out of there, and then you can deal with that specific information on its own level. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You see, what I see is, and to get back to the question before, so you can finally flesh this out, is that I know that, at least for myself, and I've experienced this with my children because they kind of brought me back and really got me on the road to questioning. Because I know for myself as a child, and I know I was taught, I was taught these six honest men. Who, what, where, when, why, and how. I was taught that, and I think it still is taught. And I was very, very inquisitive. And at some point in time, which I can't pinpoint, I don't know, that wanes. And I know that my children had to bring it back to me, especially when I really started getting into this stuff, because it was the constant questioning, and that changed my view. Let's wipe the slate clean as best we can and just question. And so we'll throw the chips up, let them fall where they may, and then we'll start the process over again. So
sure.
What happens, or is there a concerted effort that we can prove that this being inquisitive, being scientific, and being objective, that it's either diminished or it is directed at deliberately at other subjects other than, let's say, politics and sociology?
Well, I mean, we can show that this sort of activity has been going on at least since the Prussian education system, but far back before that, even the classical trivium itself shows that they're always trying to dumb down and keep the masses in control. But, you know, if you want to get into people like John Taylor Gatto, he's done extensive work showing that there has been a systematic effort to dumb children down through the compulsory education system for, you know, since the 1910s or 20s at least. And that was really one of the primary reasons, I think, for shutting down the single room schoolhouse, because in the single room schoolhouse model, you have older children teaching younger children and younger children learning from the older children. And of course, the best way to learn something is to teach it. And so then you end up with competent teacher students by the end of their eighth grade. And of course, their eighth grade graduation test was more difficult than a bachelor's degree test today. And so, you know, and a common teaching in the old single room schoolhouses was the trivium model. And, you know, so we can show that, you know, like I said, John Taylor Gatto, et cetera, have shown that there is this systematic process of this. When you engage the trivium in your own mind, it sort of naturally, you begin to see all of this and how it's done in society, how it just sort of works. And then, interestingly, with the trivium, because you can spot all of the logical fallacies, your mind eventually learns how to actually go through and reverse engineer history. So you can, you know, when you're going through and you're studying things and you understand all of the logical fallacies, your mind actually learns to flip all of the different fallacies sort of back and forth each way to see, you know, where the truth is. It does this by default when you learn the trivium. And so through this process, you can actually figure out what really happened in history. And very often you'll go back and you'll expect a piece of data to be there to prove your point, and you go right there and boop, oh, there it is, you know. And so, you know, there is a lot of that through the trivium. The trivium, for people to get an understanding of it, sort of just like a mental picture, it would be like once you get it integrated, and it really takes just about 2 years. It took me to really have it start clicking in my mind from the time I first learned about it. But it takes, once you get to that 2 year point, things really start to kick in, and it just kind of flows by autopilot. So you go from, like right now, let's say somebody lies to you. You get an implicit funny feeling. You say, you know, your intuition kicks in. You're like, something's not right here. I'm not quite sure what it is. And it's just kind of, you know, that funny sort of, I got lied to feeling. But what happens is with the trivium is that the intuition then engages the critical left side of the mind, and then it goes over there and it says, okay, intuition just told me that we got lied to, system. Let's figure out what just happened. So then it takes that implicit knowledge from the intuition and brings it over to the other side of the mind. And then it kicks in the logic side and it processes it through. And then it says, oh, hey, you know, intuition side, you were right. We just got the ad hominem attack, or we got the appeal to emotion, or, you know, whatever fallacy it was. And then you actually have the exact lie that was used against you. You can see and understand how it was used against you, and you can counter it, such as, like, you know, mental jujitsu or kung fu. So then you're not, you know, beholden to that that trick. You actually understand it exactly. But what happens is, you know, a lot of people, you know, we get lied to all of the time, and our intuition senses sort of get deadened. So the trivium actually helps us, like if you're watching the mainstream media or anything, if you even do that at all, it sort of shows you how that whole thing works. So it ends up being sort of like the, you know, in the Matrix films with the green letters coming down the screen, you can just see it all. It's like, oh, look at all of that. I couldn't see any of that before, but now I see it all. And of course, you know, in the 1800s, if you looked in a Sears catalog, you know, it was all about the facts of what the thing did and everything like that. And now you turn on the TV and it's, you know, sex appeal and your hair is going gray. You're not going to get laid anymore if you don't, you know, dye your hair or don't drink our beer or buy our car or all this kind of stuff. You know, in your average 30-second commercial, once you've studied the logical fallacies, you'll see the average 30-second commercial runs most of them in that period. And so this is just a way that we can engage the mind and filter all of this stuff out. But essentially what happens is, you know, when we first begin learning the logical fallacies and this stuff, we first filter it through the information coming in via our five senses. And then after a couple of months, once we start getting fluid with the logical fallacies and what they are, then what happens is we begin to go through and check the things in our minds. Well, where did I get that bit of information from? Oh, I have no grammar on it at all. I pulled that from my anus. And so then you go back and you're like, oh, you know, who, what, where, and when? I didn't have any. Well, how long is it going to take me to check this belief that I have? And then you check it. Oh, it was completely garbage. And then you can throw that belief out. But, you know, a lot of people will actually sit there and argue that, well, they don't have time to do research, or they don't have time to check things. A lot of times it'll take me a few seconds or a few minutes, maybe a few days or a few weeks to verify something. But can you imagine the inverse of that, where you go through your entire life believing a lie? I mean, what could be more costly and ineffective than going through your entire life believing lies and never going out to verify these facts? And like I said, you know, sometimes it's just a few minutes to go out and verify something, and you can say, oh, you know, but it's just that act of just checking your beliefs. And so what happens is a lot of other people will think, wow, you're some profound intellect because you actually spend a couple of minutes just checking the things before you believe in them, before you pass on a mental virus to others downstream.
Yeah, what I wrote on the back of my first book was, is it possible that what you think is real is just a public relations game? You know, the idea that you're a citizen and all these concepts, are they actually real? And on careful examination, it doesn't take that long. No, it's not. I think, you know, and I get in a new book about all the different psychological aspects, you know, confirmation bias, things like that, and, you know, tribalism, the need to conform to the tribe and whatnot, where people, the more they have invested in something, even though it's wrong, the more invested in it, the less likely they are to actually investigate. And that's why,
right, and the more likely they are to act completely irrationally and possibly violently towards others for daring to question.
Yeah, I mean, I get it all the time, and I said, look, if you think that IRS agents or these bureaucrats are really good people, listen to the calls on my website. I have dozens of what we call the call of shame, where I have questioned these bureaucrats. I've even confronted the Tempe City Council. They're just men and women, of course. They're just, you know, we go through and who, what, where, and when. They're just people. And I've confronted them directly on where is the evidence proving that you have any jurisdiction over me at all and that your laws apply to me at all. And I'm standing right in front of them in their building. And, you know, he came out in frustration, called me Granville, and he said, oh, you want your evidence, you want your proof, here it goes. We have jurisdiction because we said so.
Wow, that is actually circular reasoning right there.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that because it was I did bring that up to someone. I bring that up all the time, and I just want to see if we've got their position right, because I think a lot of this has to do with like a logical check when you're discussing things with people. Let me just make sure we understand each other. I understand you. Your position is the law applies because the law said so. And I was like, well, yes, and don't you see that that's circular? That's not actual evidence. That's just circular logic. That's a fallacy. So this one in Phoenix, and that's on my website, markstevens.net. He says, no, I don't see that that's circular. I said, okay, let me walk you through this. If I said to you, your code doesn't apply because the code does not apply, does that sound circular? Of course it is. Okay, so you recognize that as a logical fallacy. Yeah, okay, great. So now we'll take the reverse of that. The code applies because the code applies, or because the code said so. That doesn't sound circular to you yet? He says, well, yes, it is circular. But it's still applicable. And that's why it's on the call of shame, Jan, so people can hear these are the type of people you're dealing with. Everything.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, the real issue is that you get people and they're believing in this massive religion and they don't recognize that it's a religion. And they all put on their religious costumes, their Halloween costumes and their clown costumes and all this stuff. And then they all go around performing all of these rituals. But, you know, not one of them ever wants to step back and think for a second, you know, am I just performing a different, a ridiculous ritual because I've been fooled? You know, and so then what they have to do is they have to constantly build up that facade to protect this illusion that they've bought into, this religious lie that they've bought into, you know, and it's so funny. I mean, it's like, you know, can you point to the government? You know, well, we're in this building, so, okay, so the building is government. You know, and Larkin has done so well exposing all of this, you know, and it's like the whole thing is just completely void of logic, really. I mean, we do need to be able to have legal recourse between each other, a court. We do need to be able to protect each other. If you know, from harm and from theft, et cetera. So either having a voluntary or sheriff type system is absolutely necessary. Now, one thing I disagree with Larkin on is that I think we're already in a voluntary society, but everybody forgot that we were in one and everybody just consented and signed over their rights. And now in hindsight, we're looking back going, oh, shit, we already had a consensual society. Now we got to backpedal and try and get it back. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, I did sign that driver's license. I did sign that Social Security thing. I did sign that IRS thing. I did consent to that. I did agree that the 55 speed limit applied to me, even though it didn't say miles per hour or anything. I mean, it could have meant light years. I didn't know what it meant. I consented. And so when you get that you consent to all of these things, even that their jurisdiction applies to you to go into jail and whatnot, then you're like, oh, man, in a consensual society.
Well, I would disagree there because and we could discuss the evidence, but I want to still stick on – I got some notes here that I still want to go through as far as the trivium and critical
sure.
thought. Because one of the things that got me as an adult and looking back on is because you mentioned this a number of times. And I think this is one of the reasons why that, you know, that we were being conditioned, of course, is the compulsory education.
And sure.
At no point in time though, are the who, what, where, when, why, especially why, is applied to the concept itself of compulsory education. And if anyone was to just sit down and apply for just 10, 15 minutes, if not less, and apply who, what, where, when, and why to the idea of compulsory education, I think that if they are open and honest and they just want to know more truth and see things closer as you know than they are, as they really are, I think they would recoil in horror.
Well, let me summarize this for you and where you're going with this. And there is still a little bit of our parents' consent involved in this stuff, going back to the 1910s and 20s before John Dewey and these guys did all of this. But the quote is from Sir Thomas More from his book Utopia 1. "For if you, the rulers, suffer your people to be ill-educated and their manners to be corrupted from their infancy and then punish them for those crimes to which their first education disposed them, what else could be concluded from this but that you first make thieves and outlaws and then punish them?"
Well, of course, that's on the fallacy that the king should be a king and that the people should, that
Well, but the point is that first they're creating criminals and then they're blaming the criminals that they create. They create a dumbed down education system and then they blame the people for the education system that they're given. Okay. You know, it's like all of this Agenda 21 garbage and, you know, they're saying all of us worthless eaters and all of this stuff, eating up their resources, even though it's all of our stuff. Like they have ownership of anything and their own false appeal to authority. But, you know, this is all based on logical fallacies and all of this stuff, whereas empowering people with the logical fallacy, you know, with critical thinking would allow everyone to see the problems and you know, work towards them as individuals on their own. But you have these people who appeal to their own false authority and their own sense of genius that they alone have all of the answers and, you know, this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I had a very interesting experience when I was doing a cross-examination with an agent the other day that I would not necessarily characterize as a psychopath. Now, Rich Lavers, the lawyer who was on cross after him, total corporate psychopath. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. This guy was off the charts, and he really got to me, which is not always the case because I know the stupid lawyer tricks. But when I was talking to Mr. Leones before, and this is just a... I think what I do in a cross-examination is really just I'm applying who, what, where, when, why, and how. It's just going through that process to get to the actual evidence. And it was a real startling thing, I think, for the agent. And I don't know – I'm not saying he's going to quit his job, Jan, although I've had five cops that I know that quit after meeting me, which is – yeah, that's nice. But some of the things that came out – I was able to then use, and you could – because I was on video, I could see this. I could see the change – and something like the light bulb going off in this man's head because he had never been confronted before, I believe, with the base criminal nature of his job. And so by asking just some simple questions, again, this is on cross-examination of a tax agent, we wanted to know, I'm bringing out the involuntary, immoral nature of his interactions with Bill. And what, so, you know, basically getting to, if I ignore you, what will happen? Now, they want to stay vague, as we all know. That's what bureaucrats do and politicians. They deal in the realm of abstractions and vague generality. Okay. So what came out, Jan, and I had to write this down, because these things are important. Of course, I'm getting what I need, so you want to always write this stuff down. Of course, he said, this is a direct quote, "I will be the last friendly face you see." And now I could tell, because if you see the guy, he doesn't come off as a gangster, you know, as a thug like a typical IRS agent. "I'm the last friendly face you'll see." And then it started to dawn on him, holy crap, what the hell did I just say? But it's just using critical thought, using who, what, where, when, why, and how to get to the actual truth. And I think for the first time, this man realized, my gosh, no wonder Mark sees me as a monster. What I'm doing is consistent with a monster. And he had also said that, and they didn't want to go much further than this. He said that the punishment would be severe. And then he realized where it was going and there were objections. And he would start using softer language. So it ended with, if we don't comply still at this point, what will happen? And this is what he said to me, Jan. It will get unpleasant.
Sure. Now, what about the level of consent? I mean, you know, here's the thing is when we go into the court of record, we pull these agents into the court of record, We can, you know, the court of record, only real human beings are supposed to stand. And then we, you know, these agents aren't even supposed to be able to stand in there. But what happens is when we pull these people out of their corporate umbrella of government or whatever that they hide behind, and then we file claims on them as individual persons, then the game totally changes. And, you know, these people are trying to claim ownership over us. They're trying to claim that, you know, we've signed a contract, et cetera, which, you know, all of this stuff has to be done for them to show that you that they have jurisdiction over you. So if you file counterclaims, you can show via these counterclaims that they have no jurisdiction. But if we don't pull our own rules into the courtroom via the counterclaims, then we have to stick to the rules that they're playing by. And so this is why the counterclaim is key in countering them and showing them that no, that they don't have jurisdiction. But essentially, if you don't file those counterclaims against them, you are consenting to their authority.
Well, we disagree with that, and we can go through the evidence on that if we have time. I don't want you thinking that I'm trying to dodge the issue. I just think I got a couple notes here still to get through as far as the
sure.
critical thinking.
You know, and what we should do real quick is, you know, I do want to mention the quadrivium real quick because I did mention that early on, and we should tell people just what it is very quickly here. But the quadrivium is the higher stage of the true seven liberal arts, and it's always in this order, just like the trivium is always grammar, logic, and rhetoric. The quadrivium is arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Now, this, again, is always in this order. Arithmetic is number in itself, and it is pure abstraction or outside of space and time. And then geometry is number in space. And then music or harmonic theory is number in time. And then astronomy is number in space and time. So we can see that this is all a systematic method. And then the quadrivium builds off of the trivium. And it's basically how we go out and measure things out in the real world once we've gathered those nouns and all of that information, remove the fallacies, we know what we're dealing with, then we have a way to measure it and count it and this sort of thing as well.
Right. Until I started playing saxophone, I didn't really appreciate the significance of the number. You know,
right.
and then you start realizing all sorts of things once you start getting into and really examining the number aspect of it, like on a major scale, the first, the third, the fifth, the seventh, and whatnot. And then you start to see these relationships. On a guitar, I didn't care. I just, let me learn a couple of patterns and pentatonics and I can play Led Zeppelin. Let me, you know, well, some of it anyway.
Sure.
But once I got into the saxophone, you're kind of forced to, you need to understand those musical, well, there's a reason why the flatted fifth sounds so good against this chord. Oh, I wholeheartedly, you know, agree, and it's something that I've gotten into later here in life of getting back into a real education.
For this difference, you know, what we should do one of these days is have a nice little round table with myself and you and Bert and Dr. Tom, et cetera, and then we can all just sit down and look at all of this information and the different directions and things that we've all used and put it together, you know. Because I think we all have so much to bring to the table in this whole, you know, trying to understand the legal system and all of this stuff. So
sure, that would be great. Yeah,
you know, we've been able to show that you can bring these things into the courtroom, and basically, if you don't, you're left beholden to their rules. Basically, anything that you don't respond to on the court record is then law.
Oh, that's, yeah, they go by their standard, you know, if you don't say anything, like say, for example, if you don't actually, and this has happened in California, believe it or not, which, well, you live out there, so I'm sure you've been through this. If you don't actually use the word objection, now let's just say, I disagree with that, or you say exception, which is really the same thing. If you don't use the actual word, they will claim on appeal you did not properly object, and they cannot hear the issue, regardless of the merits. And you're
well,
like,
okay. I mean, you know, we're going into their courtroom, et cetera. But you can also, let's say, before you walk into the courtroom, you could file a document on your side that says it doesn't matter if I say I object, I dislike, I disagree, etc. And you file that in ahead of time that those are the rules that you are playing by. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get that. I just don't know about, and haven't really had any evidence presented to me, at least, about the efficiency of that or the practical application of that and where you go with that. But we can get into that. I wanted to ask, I just touch on, because one of the things that I had, And for some reason, even though we're really inquisitorial as children, and I think I may be a couple years older than you, but at least as far as back as 1980, we were still doing the nuclear drills where they would have us get under the desk. I don't know if you ever participated in that.
You know, I may vaguely remember one or two, but I would have been 9 by 1980. I don't really remember much of that.
Okay, we're practically the same age then, but I do remember that. And I know it's kind of a topic with comedians nowadays about how, how could getting under a wooden desk protect you in any way from a nuclear bomb?
Right.
You know, I make a joke about it in the book. But where, it just seemed to be, maybe, when I were discussing this, maybe in my head, there were some unwritten or unsaid rules that there were certain subjects or things that the teacher taught you that you did not question. Maybe that was just one of those. That's the only thing I can think of, because why, and it's the same thing, Jan, with things like citizenship. Why isn't the triven that these six honest men? Why are they never applied to things like citizenship? Now, my girls know. I teach them this stuff. I teach them to question it, and my girls have seen governments in action. And by government, I just mean men and women who call themselves government. So they've seen these psychopaths in action. So they do see that, they question that. And my daughter's thing is, you're not the boss of me. I'm like, that's right, babe. That's right. That goes for mommy and daddy too, by the way. But is this something that, you've thought about or you researched, that there just seems to be this block that we can challenge things scientifically? We can challenge, we talk about math and ask questions about geometry. Well, what about this, and where did this come from? But certain aspects of history and so-called citizenship just are off limits.
Well, sure. I mean, there's a lot of that. It's because, we're conditioned slaves, really, and the slaves aren't supposed to question those things. They realized in the 1800s that it was really too expensive to keep slaves on the plantation, so they could create debt slaves instead, essentially, and get everybody to, basically deal with their own retirements and things like that. It's like the women's liberation movement, let's promote women's lib and get them into the tax system by creating this new word. Basically there were men, and then there was male and female versions of men, and then they needed a new political term, so they create the word woman, and then they create women's rights. And then they taxed the other half of the population that they couldn't tax before. It was all a trick to pull them in to this whole system that they were immune from. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's For me, I think, you know, part of it comes from the trauma, too, of being... And I don't remember if I did this. If I did, okay, you know. But at 5 years old, being forced... There was no guns necessarily involved, but you are forced to be there. And it's this idea that even as a child, you know, if you don't go to school, the state or the government, which is just men and women, will permanently remove you from your parents and put them in prison.
Yeah, well, and then, you know, and then that's getting into the whole thing of do they have jurisdiction and all of that, that you can also fight them on those levels and go after them as people rather than under their state umbrella. And, you know, that's actually really shocks people when you bring them down to their level of human man on man and take their cloak away, you know, and they're left naked there. They really don't know how to react.
Well, I've seen that myself. Again, like when I was doing this just in that cross-examination the other day, the video, and we have that on video. Hopefully we can get that posted soon. I could see the changes when it was brought down to earth. When he was doing it, he was not Chris Leones, agent of the state, the government. He was just Chris. And he had to confront, like I mentioned before, maybe for the first time, he's not this omnipotent, godlike being just because he's on the clock. And this fallacy of authority was stripped bare because it came down to this. Do what I tell you, or I'll be the last friendly face you see.
Right. Well, you know, and we're seeing this with these police officers that are being challenged for their code enforcement. And, you know, instead of fighting them on the side of the road with, you know, trying to argue with the guy with a gun on the side of the road, you bring them into court and then you, demand that they show jurisdiction, demand that they show that you were in commerce, demand that they show that they weren't just an armed thug pulling you over as a highwayman on the side of the road. And then suddenly they go, oh, shoot, I'm in a really bad spot here. You know, and so then they just want to do everything to get you out of the courtroom and forget that you have the right then to sue them for everything they own.
Well, and I've spoken about that on the show before. People said, well, can't we just go in? My personal thing is I don't go into the courts unless the gun is, you know, metaphorically against my head. I just don't like it. I don't like it. And I'm not faulting people for doing it. It's just, it's my personal thing. I've spent enough time. It's like I don't do regular push-ups anymore.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's like, you know, you can, you know, there's a number of different ways to do it. You know, you can inform the officer that you're not in commerce and see how rational he is. Or you can tell him, you know, I'm going to put my driver's license and my registration here on the dashboard. If you think that you have the right to trespass against me, then there it is, et cetera. But, you know, there... You know, the thing is we need to be always make sure that we're safe and our families are safe. And when you're being pulled over on the side of the road and forced under duress to sign something, you know, and to appear into court and whatever, if you can't get out of it with the first two steps, go along and then use these things in court. But don't get yourself into a position on the side of the highway with a guy with a gun, you know, and a badge and we also have to remember that this person is a sociopath and he thinks that he has the right to pull anyone over who is making use of the highway just because they're traveling down it.
Yeah, I said, and my wife cut me off. She did not want me to continue doing this, but I got pulled over a number of months ago. And I got a ticket for not having a driver's license. And it was some other stupid thing. And the first thing I said when he got to the car was, do you have any evidence of any wrongdoing whatsoever? And my wife, just you know, and eventually, you know, I was able to trash him in court. And even though I was found guilty or responsible, the judge, Garcia, he zeroed it out. So it was like, yeah, Mark, you're right, but I'm right too. So it was one of those things. I think it comes down to also, though, that, and I've been able to do this many times, and we're just about out of time. It's not even, and the next time we talk, we can get into, of course, why it doesn't even matter whether you're engaged in commerce or not, because you can show, they can't show any evidence that even if you're using the streets as a business, that they have any jurisdiction over you to begin with. But I do see the merit and people who do want to go after them in their personal capacity and going into the small claims court to have the police officer personally held accountable. So this is something we're going to be talking with Adam.
Let me just interject here. I mean, if you get enough people doing this, how many people are going to want to be, you know, code enforcement officers? You know, the idea is to get them back over into lawful peace officers such as the sheriff.
Well, I would say that my object is to get them to have real jobs where nobody is forced to pay them. But there's also the idea, not just going to court, but you can file complaints against their insurance.
Well, on your point about paying the sheriff, you know, and we've actually talked about this a lot, is, you know, the sheriffs are, you can actually go to your sheriff, and most sheriffs should be willing to do this, and pay them directly and say, hey, you know, I'm giving you $10 or $20 or whatever for this year, and you and I have a personal agreement. If I have any trouble, you know, then you're going to pay. And I agree with you, the issue of extorting money, but you know, the issue with the sheriff, you should be able to make a personal agreement with that sheriff. The sheriff is really between you and the court clerk, you know, and that's the arrangement. The sheriff is really this sort of weird area that doesn't really fall under the others, you know. And I know, like you said, you're friends with Sheriff Mack, and you know, but there are ways that the sheriff can be utilized, such as in the manner that Larkin Rose has put forward.
And we don't have the time to get into that. I just wanted to mention again that you can file complaints against their insurance, and I definitely advocate filing a lot of complaints getting other people, because they do have to, because I have one recently with the IRS where the Treasury Inspector General's office, the investigator, called me and asked for additional evidence. So I know they're processing them, and it does cost them money and energy. But if you can get them in their personal capacity, especially like with Adam, who had a not guilty yesterday because the prosecutor didn't have evidence, that would be a situation where you go after you file a claim with the insurance, because now he's got a judgment in his favor that the prosecutor didn't have evidence, and we can prove he brought it knowing he had no evidence. So it's the same thing with the police officers, where you bring them into small claims, also with an insurance claim, but you bring him in his personal capacity because he can't hire a lawyer.
Right.
I like that aspect. I personally wouldn't go to court. I hate it. But if someone is inclined to do that.
But here's the thing, though, and I know you see this, Mark, is because if you do all of this on the side of the road and you leave it, they're just going to pull over the next guy coming down the road. Whereas if you get them into the courtroom, number one, they're off the road. Number two, if they're constantly getting sued and held personally accountable for being highwaymen, it's going to change things real fast.
I agree. I think people should do that. So
long-term strategy-wise, getting them into court, I think, is, you know, much better action.
Yeah, I agree. I always say on the show, yes, sir, no, sir, and do your best to keep your mouth shut so that you can walk away. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Again, this is the No State Project here on LRN.FM. We were not live today. We're going to be speaking with Adam also, who had a not guilty yesterday in Scottsdale, Arizona. Again, we're not live, but all new material. Jan, I appreciate you being on the show. It'll air on the No State Project for September 28th. Could you just give everyone your contact information again?
Sure. Well, they can reach me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com, and my website's GnosticMedia.com, GnosticMedia.com, and also TriviumEducation.com, that's TriVium Education.com. And, you know, everything's up there. We run strictly on donations and website sales, so we always appreciate people donating and helping us to continue what we do. And also there's a Slaves Anonymous section on there with stuff that we put out, so I'll be putting your interview with me on that page, and that's, you can actually get to that just through slavesanonymous.com as well. And there's also my shows with Freeman Burt and Clint Richardson and Dr. Tom, etc., up there. So, and I think you'll be out this way again soon, so we should be able to meet up here soon.
I think that would be excellent. I'll be, of course, in your area on the 28th when this show is airing, so maybe we'll see you then. If not, I'm out all the time. Going to the Fortified Compound in San Bernardino. So, yeah, I appreciate that. My name is Mark Stevens. There'll be more here on the No State Project in just a few moments. Don't go away. Welcome back to the No State Project. I'm your host, Mark Stevens, author of Adventures in Legal Land and the newly beta-released Government Indicted website, of course, markstevens.net. The network, you're listening live here, even though it's all new content here on LRN.FM. We are not live. We did record all this, so please do not call in, and I'm doing my best to make sure that I announce this a number of times throughout the podcast, that even though it is being broadcast during the live segment of the schedule on Saturday from 4 to 7 Eastern Standard Time, we are not live, so please do not call. We will be back live from the Fortified Compound next week, but for today, September 28th, 2013, we are not live. But I want to welcome back to the show. We've been following a number of cases that he's had. He's had a lot of success. Not everything has turned out where things have been kicked out, but Adam in Scottsdale here in the Valley of the Sun, welcome back, and you've got some good news for us again.
Yes, I had a consuming alcohol in public citation from a Scottsdale bike patrol officer way back in June 28th. Finally went to trial this past Wednesday, the 25th of September, 3 months later. Ended up being found not guilty. I brought up pretty much all of the stuff from your website and the No State Project, questions, lots and lots of motions filed, and asked all of these questions on the record at trial. I actually have it all recorded audio that I'll be sending to you shortly. And ended up being found not guilty on the grounds that there was no actual evidence beyond all reasonable doubt of alcohol in the container. I don't know if anyone's familiar with this case, but I actually decided to pick up an empty Solo cup off the ground and walk around in front of police officers to see what they would do and how they would react, because they were harassing the general public outside of Old Town Scottsdale at 10 o'clock at night, arresting people who were taking cabs to the bars, just generally harassing the public. So I wanted to see what officers would do, and I was physically restrained by an officer absent any reasonable suspicion, who then proceeded to tell me that I was consuming alcohol in public, even though the cup was empty and I held it upside down for him. He lied in all of his statements, and actually on the witness stand yesterday, saying that he saw me consuming alcohol and there was alcohol in the container. Lots of lies. It'll be a great audio to listen to when I get it posted to you. But basically found not guilty because he never actually tested the quote-unquote alcohol that was in the container.
Not that that would have mattered, though. I mean, who cares? You know, I mean, but what I want to – because, I, you know, we had mentioned about misconduct on the part of the prosecutor. Because didn't you bring this up in pretrial at all?
Bringing this all up, and I gave the prosecutor plenty of opportunities to drop the ticket. I told her, I gave her a list of witnesses and told her, or the prosecutor's office, exactly what each witness was going to testify to, corroborating my story, which I just said. And then I also gave her a statement of facts stating that exact same thing. And then I asked her, have you even talked to the police officer yet? Did you even read the police report? And she just called me, said, no, I don't need to. The ticket says you were drinking in public, so we're going to prosecute you.
So even though she knew she had no evidence, you presented this to her, you told her that you had witnesses with personal firsthand experience that this was, that there was no evidence to support this bogus charge, instead of doing the right thing and dropping it, she dug her heels in.
Correct. And that's additional to all of the No State Project conversation points. Again, I was pressing a lot of the topics of requesting or demanding evidence of jurisdiction, applicability of the code, all of that stuff. There's many motions filed with your help. There's audio of actually me interviewing the prosecutor for pretrial discovery that's been posted on YouTube and posted on your site. And again, I think she actually had a really good line. She said, well, we don't need to give that to you. And if you feel we aren't giving you evidence, then you have to compel the judge to make us do it. When I asked her the evidence jurisdiction, evidence of applicability of the code, she said, well, all we're doing is calling the officer. The officer says you're in Scottsdale, so we're prosecuting.
Right. And I know that one of the things that I asked, and I actually spoke with Bonnet, who actually seemed like a decent guy.
Did you actually like another call with him?
Yeah, I did have a call with him. I spent about 15, 20 minutes on the phone with him. He's actually, as far as cops go, a fairly, you know, decent fellow. And, you know, I'd ask them, well, what evidence is there that just because I'm physically in Scottsdale, your constitution and laws actually apply to me in any shape or form? And of course, he wasn't able to give me anything. And no cop can. It's not just a matter of, and no prosecutor can. It's not a matter of, well, Mark, the cops, you know, I mean, come on, the cops aren't lawyers. They're not expected to know that. No, yes, they are. The hell they're not. If they are going to be making accusations that the law applies to me, then, yeah, they need to have the evidence to actually back that up. Of course they do.
Yeah, just for people who aren't familiar, I actually had a 27-minute witness interview with the citing police officer, and I warmed up just asking him questions about that night and his experience in training, and then as soon as I began asking about the citation, evidence of jurisdiction, he became agitated, accused me of arguing with him, and then...
Yeah, right. And that's standard. That's a standard thing that they do. And you've been through this a number of times now. You know how this goes. You ask a question, where is your evidence? And instead of answering, they lie and try to deflect the attention away and accuse you, falsely accuse you of arguing.
Absolutely.
Right.
And interesting, your other No State Project member, Dan Gould, was at the trial earlier this week. I'm sure he's got some comments about it, too. But when under direct examination, the prosecutor asked the officer those same questions. He made his testimony and he said, you know, the defendant was in the city of Scottsdale and he broke the law. So I cited him. And each one of those statements, I said, objection calls for legal conclusion. And the judge overruled that objection.
Were any grounds given?
Nope, just that his statement is fact. He said his statement and his observations are facts and testimony.
So did you say nobody has put into evidence at all what the city of Scottsdale is since the
Absolutely.
City? Okay.
And the judge said his testimony is evidence. So now then when it was my turn to cross-examine, I asked that exact same question and the various iterations that followed down that line of questioning. And every single time the prosecutor said the same objection, calls for legal conclusion.
Now, when the prosecutor made this, what was the prosecutor's name?
I don't know off the top of my head. It was a female, I think a Cynthia or Karen. I'll find it in a second.
Okay, well, let's just say assume Karen because it's easier. Now, Karen's making the same objection to the same witness that you made. Yours was overruled with no explanation. When what happened? Did the judge sustain or overrule her objections?
Sustained her objection and said he is not qualified. He doesn't have to testify to a legal conclusion.
Did you object and point out that the judge had already overruled your same objection?
Absolutely.
And what did this legal scholar on the bench, you know, 4 feet off the floor, what did this legal scholar have to say in response to that?
I said it doesn't matter. It calls for a legal conclusion, and he doesn't need to answer it. Tried pressing and saying, wait, so are you saying that he's not qualified to answer this question? Because I think this response I had written down from your material is, well, he wrote the ticket. He was the one who made this decision that I broke the law. He stated under direct examination that I broke the law. So how is this not calling for a legal conclusion? Is it his opinion or is it fact that I broke the law? Because under direct examination, you allowed him to make that statement. The judge simply said he's not qualified to testify to that.
Unbelievable. Did you move? Well, not unbelievable. I take that back. Strike that. We expect that because that's what these criminals do. So let me ask you, when they said that the witness was not qualified to give such legal determinations, like you broke the law or you violated the state code.
The city of Scottsdale.
Yeah. The ordinance of the city of Scottsdale, which is still a legal conclusion that you violated the law, which he did on the penalty of perjury, or he certified, which is, you know, to have a valid ticket, it's always certified, at least in Arizona. So did you ask the judge to then be consistent and then strike his testimony, including his prior testimony that you violated the law on the ticket?
Yes, several times. Every time the prosecutor made her objection on my cross-examination, I motioned to strike previous testimony, and the judge denied it.
Any grounds given?
Nope.
Wow. Okay. So basically what you're telling me, Adam, is this is playing out pretty much the way so many of these other ones have played out, that the decision, you know, the judge, at least up to that point, had you as guilty. And so everything the judge was saying, you know, had to conform to that, which, because that, to me, that's the only logical explanation as to why the judge is adamantly going to overrule your objection and then sustain it when the prosecutor, when Karen does it. And then even after they say the witness is not qualified, not strike the testimony. There's no other rational explanation for that, because if they were a fair, impartial, independent decision maker, the moment they sustained an objection that the witness was not qualified to say you've broke the law, they would have stricken all, you know, the legal opinions from the record, including the one that, on the ticket that started the whole mess in the first place. But that's
And what's interesting too, you know, I was actually fairly surprised. I have the same judge that I dealt with a month ago for hearing on motions, this guy named Joseph Olkovich, the leading judge for the city of Scottsdale, and I actually filed a motion to disqualify him based on your help and your material, you know, calling him out for all the things you just stated, fair and impartial, all that stuff. And, you know, surprisingly, he was fairly level-headed and was not angry or yelling or furious like my previous court experiences, but very obviously had the unfair rulings against me, but he was very level-headed considering the fact that I filed motions to disqualify him.
Well, maybe he knew that you unfortunately had to lose some money by filing a petition for special action to have him disqualify himself, because obviously if you're assuming jurisdiction on behalf of the prosecutor and an element of the code violation and not presuming innocence, that kind of, you know, makes it impossible to have a fair hearing.
Absolutely. It's interesting. There's probably a good 15 minutes at the beginning of the audio from the trial where I'm actually going through, you know, warming up before we even start the trial, asking the judge these type of No State Project questions. And, you know, it's just I'm baffled by how he's just able to contradict everything. I mean, it warms up like, do you have to agree to the Supreme Court rulings and the Constitution and all that stuff? Said yes, yes, yes. And then I read him the direct quote about corpus delicti and requiring evidence of jurisdiction. And he says, well, that's for the trial. I don't need to abide by that right now. And if there is none, we'll find you not guilty. But then, well, I just read you the thing that said you can't even have the trial if you don't have this to start with. So how can you have a trial and find me not guilty? You know, how is this? You have to dismiss it. You're required to dismiss it because you just said you are required to obey by the Supreme Court and the Constitution.
And basic principles of fairness. I mean, this is something, Adam, I'm going through with this, you know, circus up in New Hampshire. And the idea, you know, this has happened a number of places in New Hampshire, by the way. And they're under the impression that jurisdiction is something that you establish at trial. And that is so far removed from reality. And what it's just like, I think someone mentioned that, oh, jurisdiction is a sentencing issue. I think someone on the chat brought that up, because I'm sure at some point they will say something. Oh, okay, you're Skyping me. Paula Dixon was the prosecutor, so it wasn't Karen, but Paula Dixon. We'll get back to her in just a moment. But there's this thing where they believe that I don't know if I got a chance to report this on the show. Maybe I did, but there was the psychopath Michael King in the Ian Freeman situation where he's saying that I kept on insisting that the plaintiff had the burden of proof on jurisdiction.
Is that the one hung up on you?
No, well, yeah, he's the one that deleted my he cut my transmission.
Right.
And he was saying that the psychopath Michael King, he was saying in this decision, in, you know, to deny the motion for rehearing, that I kept on insisting that jurisdiction was an issue and a burden to be proven by the prosecution before there's any kind of hearing. He said that just my merely repeating it over and over didn't make it true, which I agree. That it's true because that's a basic principle of fairness, and even the courts have agreed with that. And he said that I presented no authority because there is none. Now, that would be like saying I have to provide some kind of authority to show that I'm entitled to a fair hearing, or I'm entitled to be informed of the nature and cause of the charge of proceedings. Or, you know, it is so well established in law that it requires no citation. It's just like the presumption of innocence. Do you think that you can go into the Constitution or of any of the constitutions and actually see where a presumption of innocence is spelled out? Have you ever seen that? I don't think I've ever read a constitution where, and I could be wrong, there may be some out there, I haven't read every single one.
It's Supreme Court citations and rulings.
But it's a commonly accepted principle of American Anglo law that of the presumption of innocence. But I don't see it set forth in a
thousands of citations.
Yeah.